Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Well, ladies and gentlemen, today we have not one, but two interviews done by film sociology correspondent McKenna Mays, and I think we can finally make it official. Well, we've known, I just haven't actually announced it here on the show. Our McKenna is not only graduating very soon, but she has a reporting job lined up for her when she graduates. So congratulations to McKenna. She's already ahead of the game, at least when I was graduating from college. So congratulations to her, and of course I've appreciated all the interviews that she's done. And she's fit the mold, of course, as I can make anything fit into the film show, whether it's stage sociology, music sociology, what have you. So anyway, we're going to hear her interviews with Brian Fonseca and Tim Brickley of The Phoenix, as well as Andrew Magana and Deborah Silvius, hope I'm saying those right, who are the owners of the White Rabbit Cabaret. And then I got a big old bag of stuff I wanted to catch up on, some stuff that opened in theaters last week that I'm still trying to play catch up with. I missed a screening this week, so we're kind of looking back. Some films that I've watched recently, old and new. We dip into the archives. We haven't done that segment in a while. And I have an update because I've become intrigued, of course, with the film Sergeant Stubby, an American Hero. And we probably will dip into the archives in the second half of the show. But first, here is McKenna Mays interviewing Brian Fonseca and Tim Brickley of the Phoenix Theater.
So I want to start out with kind of like your big news. You guys are moving buildings. So what kind of prompted that?
Well, actually, it was years in the making, but it was really pushed most recently because of parking problems. But we knew about 5 years ago that we were starting to run out of space, and if we were going to achieve our next set of five-year plans and goals, that we would have to have a larger facility.
So then will God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater be like your first big production there?
It is. It is the premier production in the new space, and it's so exciting because, you know, we found this piece. We listened to the Encore series and realized, holy smokes, here's a true gem that just hasn't been produced since its original time in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And it's Kurt Vonnegut. It was perfect association. It was just like kismet. This is it. This is what it is for us. I was looking for the right piece, agonizing over it. Passed it around. Tim really liked it, and that was important. and thought we could do something. And I think the story was that I gave it to you and said, hey, I really like this, but you know what? I don't really like the arrangements on this. Could you do something wonderful with this?
Yes, that's how you put it. So I listened to it, and I thought there was really an amazing score there. And it was a great find to actually be able to open the Phoenix with this little-known Kurt Vonnegut Broadway musical that only ran for 45 performances in 1979. This will be only the third professional production of it ever, and the first time it's not been on the East Coast. So, and it was the first musical from Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, this team that went on to... this kind of was a failure in its time, and their second show was Little Shop of Horrors, which became the longest-running off-Broadway play and a movie. And then they started working, doing Disney musicals, Little Mermaid, so it was the first start of, you know, their great career. And it's a really interesting, great, quirky musical.
And what is it about for people who are unfamiliar?
Yeah. It's kind of a Don Quixote journey for... Elliot Rosewater, who is trying to find his purpose and his mean and the meaning of life, as Kurt Vonnegut says in the novel, like, what are people for? It's really an examination of what's our meaning, what's our purpose. What's fascinating to me is how far ahead of the time he was. You know, there's just an examination of what became essentially the welfare system, this great buy into a socialist movement. He makes fun of both the rich, the powerful, and the poor alike. So it's what it's about. That's always a tough question. It's about a man who runs a foundation with a lot of money, and he's giving money away without truly a lot of focus, but just to give it away. He has his own demons that he's working through, and he goes on this journey, and he finds himself back in the family hometown of Rosewater County, Indiana. And through that journey and meeting those people, giving them respect, finding respect for himself, he really truly finds just what is life all about.
And does it differ much from the actual novel?
To me, it's one of the best adaptations of a novel to a musical I've ever seen in all my years of doing this with Brian. Because it's, you know, it's kind of hard to capture the tone of Vonnegut because he's kind of satirical and it's quirky and a reviewer once said Vonnegut was a bitter coating around a sugar pill. And so it's capturing that tone is hard, but no, it follows the novel very faithfully, very concise. It's a really great, great treatment.
And I think you actually told me that, Tim, you're friends with someone who was friends with Vonnegut?
Well, yeah. Through the years, I've become pals with Dan Wakefield, the great Indiana writer who was one of Vonnegut's best pals through the years, you know, in New York. And so Dan was not very familiar with this musical, but he talked to Kurt's daughter, Edie, who was one of the original producers, and she filled him in on it. And he's really been enjoying digging back into it. And so he's written a little bit for the program, and he's going to lead a panel discussion after one of the performances.
On the second Sunday.
On the second Sunday of the run. And he got to come to a read-through, the first read-through, which is really fun. Like, so in theater, everyone sits around a big table, and you introduce yourself, and you just sort of read through the play on the first day. And Dan got to come and sit in. And, you know, he said it was a nice experience for him. It brought him back to his days in Greenwich Village in the 50s, sitting around little theaters, watching Allen Ginsberg do his stuff. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was fun.
So has he told you anything, like, cool or interesting about Vonnegut that you didn't know before?
A million things, yeah. Whenever we chat. The best tip he gave me was he edited, a couple of years ago, he edited a collection of Vonnegut's letters and wrote prefaces to each sort of time period, and which really serve as a good sort of biographical blueprint. And so that's been a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But no, he knows a lot.
I'm an English minor at Franklin, so this kind of stuff is just so fascinating to me.
Well, yay.
Yeah. What kind of, like, what's the thought process and decision-making that goes into deciding what kind of productions that you're going to put on?
Well, we have a mission that we established early on and a vision for what it is that we wanted to do in Indianapolis that we've been sticking true to. We produce the most current plays available to us, so fresh out of New York or on its way to New York. And we're looking for plays that really speak to what's happening in society around us. If we're trying to make a more enlightened community, we need to be aware of what are the community needs and concerns. And there's so much literature out there, so much art out there that can, in its own unique way, make the world a better place. So we open the doors for dialogue. That's what our purpose is. We present something and a place to have a conversation afterwards. But what's unique about the Phoenix is the intimacy of the stage. So whatever you're experiencing is so firsthand. You feel like you're part of the conversation with the actors. And so our purpose is, number one, to find that material that is addressing the concerns of the community, and also to be entertaining, also to explore new genres, new ways of putting on plays or having conversations with the community. New series might include spoken word, a music series, a public speakers forum, kind of a town hall series. It's all about how do we have conversations with our community.
Mm-hmm. And you guys really do extend out into the community. You offer classes, you help artists in Indianapolis. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Our outreach is really growing, and the new building is going to help us expand that program. So we have a facility, and immediately we thought, you know, this is much bigger than just what should be much more than just the Phoenix Theater. So we opened up our doors and have created a program to help other companies kind of incubate them, to offer them professional guidance and services, and really as part of a collective, a little bit of a discount from what we would charge other groups, but also a place where we can sit together as artists and just have conversations. Our outreach into the near west side is to take art and training and to make it more accessible to communities that do not have access currently. And eventually what we'll do is try to create these little nests on the west side, maybe the near east side, maybe a little bit south, and with, of course, following what our mission is, the kind of programs that we like to present, and take those to other communities. And so we try to remove barriers. Our classes on the west side, many of them are in Spanish, because that's the community population out there. And we're going to offer training for theater professionals and then training for the next generation, mm-hmm. for young artists.
So now Mr. Rosewater is based on the classic Vonnegut novel. Do you guys have any favorite films that are based off of classic novels, adaptations that you think have done the novel justice?
Wow.
Not just Vonnegut. I mean, yeah. Whoa, that opens up everything.
Yeah, that's a giant question.
Yeah.
McKenna? Favorite film from a novel? I would say One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is one of my favorite adaptations of a novel. The Ken Kesey novel to the Milos Forman movie is, mm-hmm. I think, captured it as well as can be done.
Yeah, great movie.
I love Apocalypse.
Heat's on you, boss.
Apocalypse Now.
Wow.
You know, I don't know how much it. I would say that it stayed exactly close to the original novel, but man, what a great adaptation!
What about you?
Yeah,
I actually think my favorites are Baz Luhrmann's, his adaptations, so Romeo and Juliet and The Great Gatsby.
Wow,
I like kind of that weird vibe that he puts on it, paired with like the soundtrack of like modern music versus like books that were written and like a pastime.
Yeah, where he sets it in sort of a non-determined time state. Yeah.
I love the visual style of storytelling. And, you know, I have to say it's probably my favorite adaptation of Shakespeare was Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. It made my senior English class like way more interesting.
You know he's done operas.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I think that you can still see some things perhaps through the New York Public Library.
Okay.
Once again, just full of great visual style.
Great. So when and where can people see God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater?
Well, we're in the new space, and we officially open on May 10th. And you're going to have to get tickets by going on our website, phoenixtheater.org, or calling the box office at 317-635-7529. It's going to run for 4 weeks, from May 10th through June 1st, and we have shows Thursday through Sundays. And you can get all of that information online, and it is immediately followed by a production by a local playwright, playwright in residence Tom Horan, called The Pill, on the creation of the birth control pill. And so we're hitting the ground running. Two shows, simultaneous performances, and by September we'll be full service.
McKenna Mays speaking with Brian Fonseca and Tim Brickley of the Phoenix Theater. All right, we now shift gears. Here's McKenna talking with Andrew and Deborah of the White Rabbit Cabaret.
So White Rabbit Cabaret kind of has like a little bit of everything. How would you kind of explain it to someone?
I'd explain it, I guess, is we're an art house. So we do all different types of events and really focusing on variety, just because we feel like Indianapolis has a nice open home for that, where you can have all different types of art forms in one place.
Yeah, we do everything from comedy to, I mean, stand-up. We do a lot of sketch comedy.
We do game shows.
Movie nights. We have a lot of in-house productions that we do,
mm-hmm.
Which is quite entertaining. We have movie nights, like a monthly movie night.
Theater, dance.
Mm-hmm. Dance, yeah, modern dance. Yeah.
So how did you guys originally come up with the idea?
Originally, my background is in classical modern dance, and moving here to Indianapolis, I thought we just needed a few more art spaces that could house different types of performances, and we just needed some more physical spaces for people to get their art out. So that was the original concept.
And what are some of the events that you guys have coming up?
Like I said, we do a wide host of our own produced shows. We have a Let's Make a Date. It's a live dating game show we do about every month or so. We have the Wowie Zowie Show, which is like a variety entertainment show hosted by a couple old guys, characters. And we bring in all different kinds of art forms for that. It's a kind of a great example of the wide array of stuff that we house at the White Rabbit. Mm-hmm. You know, we have stand-up comedy, dance, mm-hmm. on that show.
All in one show, yeah.
It's hosted and judged by a couple characters that kind of rotate every month.
Mm-hmm.
We also have the Bingo Bango Show, which is a staple at the White Rabbit. We've been doing it for 8 years now. It's kind of a wacky, off-the-wall
thing. Yeah, it's
goes.
A crazy
yeah.
game show. You come in and
host
actually play bingo.
Hosted by clowns, nevertheless, dancer, you know. So it's a little off the wall.
Mm-hmm. And so how long have you guys been in Fountain Square?
The full 8 years. We started in 2010, but started our construction in 2009. So Fountain Square was still kind of up and coming, so mm-hmm. we got to watch the whole area kind of build up around us while we were been there, you know, for 8 years
it's
doing our
quite
thing.
Different nowadays.
Yeah.
It's a new beast, but beautiful. It's
yeah.
wonderful.
It was nice to be a part of that and kind of see everything start to evolve, you know.
They have kind of like this great like art community support type thing. So do you feel like you get a lot of local support by being there?
We do. I mean, we feel like it's been one of those things that's been great to help foster, and it just keeps growing. So I think that was one of our major goals of even existing. So mm-hmm. that feels really good, and it's nice to watch everything kind of expand around it, and hopefully it'll just continue to grow.
I know there are actually a few live performance venues in Fountain Square. Do you see that as competition, or do you think you guys have something that's just like distinctly unique that makes each of you different?
You mean, of course, it's competition, but you know, it's great that we all try to find our own little niche. You know, I think that the White Rabbit definitely offers a lot of our own specific shows that are that we create. So you know, anytime you can create your own product, you're going to differentiate yourself enough to hopefully have your own audience. So, you know, a lot of them cater more to the music side of things.
Mm-hmm.
We do quite a bit of music, but definitely more varied than that. So
how do you think a night out at White Rabbit is different from, like, a night out in any other, like, nightclub or something in Indianapolis?
I think a night out at the White Rabbit, you kind of don't know what you're going to get in a great and beautiful way. Our shows are always different. Even if it is a show you've seen before with us, it's going to have a different feel, and you kind of, you know what to expect quality-wise, but you don't know what's actually going to happen with a lot of our shows, and I think that that's always fun and entertaining and kind of a nice, it can be as casual as you want it, or it can be as fancy or as fun. There's a lot of variety, I think, when you come and enjoy a show at the Rabbit.
Yeah, we also have great staff, you know,
our staff.
From our door person to our bar staff. We're all fabulous, and try to focus on treating the customer in a way. I mean, I guess plenty of other places do that too, but
sure.
I like to pride ourselves on that.
So what's some of the planning that kind of goes into these events?
A lot of planning goes into these events. Every day of our lives.
I mean, every show has its own obstacles and own, you know, set of things that have to be done, whether it's like the Wowie Zowie show, you have to book all the talent. We have a great person, Isaac Lanford, that helps with that. You know, everything from the booking of the talent to the technical aspects, the scheduling of everything.
Rehearsals sometimes. Shows are rehearsed.
Mm-hmm.
So you have some burlesque events. Obviously, there's more, but do you have any favorite films that are based off of burlesque or cabaret?
Good question. We do a monthly movie night at the White Rabbit called Frankie's Flicks, sponsored by Upland. They bring it free time series, so they make it free. So it's a free event every month. This the last few we've done have been kind of requested movies. We just did Space Jam.
We're doing Space Jam.
What about Bob? Mm-hmm. Days of Confused. But as far as what you're asking about the burlesque, we've showed Showgirls. That was fun. You know,
it was kind of fun.
Yeah, you know, it was actually well attended. People loved it. You know, it's kind of campy and fun like that. So that's the one I kind of.
Yeah, and we haven't showed any of the classics, I guess, in that arena. Like we haven't shown Chicago or anything like that,
or Cabaret.
Yeah. Maybe for the future.
It's always an option.
Yeah, because we know everyone loves those and.
How would you kind of describe one of your burlesque shows?
That's an interesting one.
Well, I mean, we do, we have the Rockabelle Review is kind of our in-house burlesque trip of sorts. You know,
We work with them quite often.
We have for many years. And I would say every one of their shows has a different approach, you know, has a different theme. You know, they range from comical to sexy to, you know.
Yeah, they have a lot of different themes. We also do one that we produce in-house called the Burlesque Ballyhoo. And it's kind of, it's not usually themed, but unless it's maybe around a holiday time, then we'll do kind of a spooky one for Halloween. And that's kind of more of a mixed bag. You might have some cabaret dancers on it. You might have drag. You might have, so we mix it up a little bit, some classic burlesque in there too. So that's one where it's a little bit maybe a broader term of the word burlesque. And then with the Rockadoll Review, it'll be more your classical version of striptease. Yeah. So they do a really good job with that within the themes that they choose. And
so I know you guys have a lot of events coming up. How can people, do they just show up or do they get tickets beforehand? How does that work?
Well, we have, you know, can always visit our website, whiterabbitcabaret.com. There's all of our confirmed events are listed there. And many events are ticketed and it would be available to purchase right there on the website. We do a few shows that are pay at the door.
Like Let's Make a Date or the Bingo Bango show. Yeah. Those are just come, pay at the door, come as you are type of shows. And then other ones might have some tickets involved.
All right. Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
McKenna Mays interviewing Andrew Magana and Deborah Silvius of the White Rabbit Cabaret. Couple programming notes. Next week's Film Sociology is a special one because we haven't had this in a while. I got a substitute guest, or substitute host, I should say. McKenna Mays is going to be hosting next week's program. This is kind of her unofficial final exam, and she'll be interviewing John Krull, of course, of Franklin College journalism fame, and of course the host of No Limits. So I'll be in studio as well. So there'll be a trio of conversation with the three of us. But she'll be sitting at the host desk, which really doesn't help for radio. And also last week, she moderated, basically ran off titles, but something I've always wanted to do with John. And John Krall and I broke down every single film made by Elvis Presley, all 33. We count the two concert documentaries. So McKenna would kind of, if you've seen shows like Pardon the Interruption or anyway, those programs. Anyway, she's the one. She would throw us the title, and then John and I would discuss it. So, and we went so long. It's going to be a two-parter. So, because it's 33 Elvis films. So anyway, that will be aired sometime this summer. Anyway, it was a lot of fun, and John is a bigger Elvis fan than I, and it shows. So it was a lot of fun doing that. So anyway, that will be later this summer. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back after break, I got a lot of stuff I wanted to clear off the desk and share these with you, and if there's room, if there's time, we might dip into the archives. You never know. That's the beauty of and the unpredictability of radio here at WFYI. So stick around. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org.
Robert Irvine, and you're listening to Film Sociology, WFI in Indianapolis.
Just a friendly reminder of myself to try to get Robert back on the show again. It's always fun. Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Socey. All right, full disclosure, the one film I thought I was going to be able to see this week, I missed the screening because life, ladies and gentlemen, sometimes gets in the way. So I apologize to the diehard film fans out there about having nothing new to report this week. I do know, of course, Bad Samaritan. If you want to see one of your favorite Doctor Who's as a bad guy, that is open this weekend, as well as Tully, the latest collaboration between Diablo Cody and Jason Reitman with Charlize Theron. By the way, if you remember, if you're a long, long time listener, Tracy Mitchell, one of the old film sociology correspondents, not thrilled with hearing Charlize Theron complain about putting on the weight and then being able and then taking it off. As I believe it was Janine Garofalo who said, "What about the actresses who had the weight to begin with?" Other people have said that as well. So anyway, I'm hopefully going to be seeing Tully. Hopefully this weekend. And Godard Mon Amour is also opening this weekend. And I have to say, I did an interview on the show last week with Russell Harbaugh, the director, writer and director, and Wabash graduate of the film Love After Love, the one with Andy McDowell and Chris O'Dowd, about the two grown men dealing with the death of their father and the life continuance of their mother, wonderfully played by McDowell. I finally got to see the show last week, and ladies and gentlemen, it's really good, and not just because he was on the show. What I liked about it is and we talked about this in the interview. There are certain film. There's a number of big studio films out now, in the last several years, that portray people of a certain age when they are considered quote unquote old, or older. That relations. Sexual relations, nudity aspect, all of those are used as a punchline, or the fact that that people of a certain age having feelings and having relationships are used kind of as a punchline. That's not the case here. What I also liked about the film is that you have to pay attention. There are no it's seamless in its movement of time. So you have to pay attention. And I mean, you don't have a moment of, you know, they're not using the four seasons and letting you show, and then a shot of leaves falling or snow falling or, you know, coming back on the trees, things like that. You really have to pay attention. It's a brave role for Andie MacDowell. She opens herself up physically and emotionally after years and years of playing the wife and the mother. O'Dowd gets to do, as we said in the interview, not the most likable protagonist. And it's kind of a throwback to the 1970s when you could have somebody unlikable but intriguing as your lead. He does some pretty shoddy stuff in this. But anyway, it's a film that's good enough that I see a trailer for something like Book Club and I really cringe. And it's going to make those experiences, I think, even worse from now on. So thank you to Russell Harbaugh and everybody involved with Love After Love. I really enjoyed it. And I try to see stuff before interviewing somebody so it doesn't come off too much like no offense to those people that do it. They do it better than me, but a morning show interview. So there you go. Now, I got so wrapped up with talking with Evan Dossie on last week's program. I also forgot to mention, and it kind of died quickly here in town, but so you're not going to have to look for it on video. I believe this is the old segment of Where Were You, a film it's actually pretty good and not enough people got to see it. But the film Final Portrait, the film that's directed and adapted by Stanley Tucci, starring Armie Hammer, Jeffrey Rush, Tony Shalhoub's in this, always good to see him. And it's a story of a writer who gets to be the subject of a famed painter and sculptor. Armie Hammer is the writer and Jeffrey Rush is the painter. And what was supposed to be maybe a day or two to create the portrait goes on a lot longer. And the bond between subject and artist turns into friendship, very complicated. It's an amusing look at the creative process. If you have ever been a creator in one way, shape, or form, cooking, sculpting, anything, if you make glass art, one person's eyes may say it looks fine. Meanwhile, it's digging at your brain. It's driving you crazy. It doesn't look right. You feel worthless. And that's what happens in this film. Rush takes quite a while for it to get moving. He drops F-bombs unlike anybody else. So at the very least, you should go rent this and check it out when it comes out on video in a few months. I'm very excited because I like both actors. And the fact that it's directed by Stanley Tucci, who's, let's review one of my all-time favorite films of the last, over 20 years, is Big Night, which was his first film. Since then, he, of course, did The Imposters, Joe Gould's Secret, Blind Date, and now this. So every few years, so 1996, Big Night, 1998, The Imposters, 2000, Joe Gould's Secret, 2007 for Blind Date, and 2017 for Final Portrait. So I'm always intrigued to see what he has to offer as a director. We know what he can do as an actor. And has he come close to Big Night? No, but it's still fascinating to watch. So anyway, look out for Final Portrait when it comes out on video. It only lasted a week here in Indianapolis, sadly. All right. By the way, happy graduation weekend to those who are graduating this weekend. I've been there. Hope all is well. Hope and the only other piece of advice I can get you, because I'm not asked to speak at graduation ceremonies. Quality over quantity. There you go. Now, over at IU Cinema on Thursday, May 10th, it'll be filmmaker Robert B. Weeds and The Making of Kurt Vonnegut, Unstuck in Time. That is going to be airing at 7 p.m. on Thursday, May 10th. And I believe then the IU Cinema takes a little nap during the summer. At the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, of course, at 2 and 7:30 p.m. on the 5th, on today, if you're listening today, Back to the Future Part 2. And then, and that's sponsored, of course, by the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, that's why. Tuesday, May 8th, starting at 6 o'clock, there will be a free book discussion and then the screening of Little Women, the Winona Ryder version with Susan Sarandon and that lot from 1994, if I remember correctly. So it's brought to you by the Johnson County Library. Again, book discussion at 6. I guess there's going to be prizes and an intro at 6:45 and then the movie at 7 o'clock. Friday and Saturday, May 11th and 12th at the Artcraft Theater in Franklin, The Wizard of Oz. And then Thursday, May 17th, because I like these, and then sometimes it becomes stage sociology, you know that, Pappy Wilson's Spring Thaw. As listed on the website, a fun-filled live radio broadcast-style performance. So it's a radio play. It's not being broadcast anywhere. It just looks like it's being broadcast. I got to direct one of these earlier this year at Scottish Rite Cathedral. I love radio plays. Hopefully you can go check that out. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In. Okay, here we go. On Screen 1, Movie 1, The Avengers, Infinity War. Again, I liked it. I'm just not as emotionally wrapped up in it as other people, especially those who are in my age range. Screen 2, or Movie 2, Black Panther. All in the timing on that one. Screen 2, Rampage, followed by A Quiet Place. Screen 3, Truth or Dare, followed by The Avengers Infinity War. Okay. And then on Screen 4, Super Troopers 2, followed by I Feel Pretty. Okay. Over at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, you have The Avengers, Infinity War, and A Quiet Place. That is happening there. All right. Want to catch up on some videos that were sent to me, and I'm trying to catch up, so you know, thank you to distributors for waiting on me. We got a film called Soledad Jeannette, listed as a European film conspiracy. All right. I think a Spike Lee joint is as far off the rails as I want when coming to describing a picture. But it's what happens when somebody dumps all of her material goods and goes on the run, and the consequences that go with that. Austrian-German film. Thankfully short, has some stuff to say. But overall, it's all right. I know it's not the most glowing thing, but that's how much of an effect it had. And it's also been several weeks since I watched it. We also have a Romanian fable called So Bright Is the View. And this is a film of a young girl trying to get her life in order, expecting a baby, and trying to work out a future with her boyfriend. And it's a film that has a lot of long takes. So there's a lot of long takes with two people scenes, which are hard to do. The only thing going against this film is just it's a low energy picture and low energy performances. So it's one thing when you have long takes and high energy, like in a Cassavetes film, or yeah, even something like Clerks. Low energy, it drags. Got this sent to me via, I believe this was through a Film Movement, but is E. Nesbitt's The Railway Children, and the story of siblings whose father is imprisoned, and they and their mother have to move from London to a cottage out in the country where they wind up befriending the local railway porter. And I intrigued that I got this. And then when I find out that it's not a film, but it is a filmed play. However, that being said, it looks cool as far as, and they shot it, I'm not sure exactly where they did, but in an alley theater. It might have been an old train station. At least I think, I'm hoping that's what it was. Because there is an actual physical train as a prop in the production. So I should have checked up on that. That's, if you're intrigued, you should check that out. But York Theatre Royal and the National Railway Museum. So yeah, it was probably in a railway station. So yes, theater can be done anywhere. Good use of space. And it's kind of a BBC masterpiece kids show. But yeah, it looks cool. It was good. Then we have the Australian film Jasper Jones, a film by Rachel Perkins, who I remember did the Aborigine musical Brand New Day, also with Jeffrey Rush. Also enjoyed that. And this is kind of a coming-of-age story set in a small Australian town in 1969 where you have two boys from different sides of the tracks who have a friendship, but there's also a dangerous secret that has to be learned because that's what happens when you have young kids. But it almost has a Huck and Huckleberry Finn feel to it a little bit. The film also features Toni Collette as the mom. Hugo Weaving is kind of the Boo Radley character where he is feared and nobody knows what he's really like. And Angerie Rice is in this, who I remember as the girl who played Ryan Gosling's daughter in The Nice Guys. So, good family film. A little challenging. Okay, we dip into the archives, or as Kobe used to say, this is one of those films that you could buy online. You can't get it in the store, or as Kobe used to say, I'll burn it for $5. This is a comedy from 1967 called The Busybody. And it stars Sid Caesar as a bumbling gopher who works for mob boss Robert Ryan. And there is $1 million in cash that has been sewn into a suit. And it turns out to be the suit was accidentally put onto a corpse. And then they have to find the body. Guess what? The body's not dug up, not dug where it should be. And hilarity ensues. A lot of familiar faces, especially early in their careers. So you have Sid Caesar, who's actually one of the veteran faces in this, and Robert Ryan, and Ann Baxter, and Kay Medford. But this was the film debut of Richard Pryor. Also showing up in the film includes young Dom DeLuise, Godfrey Cambridge, Marty Ingalls, George Jessel. You also have Arlene Galunka to look at, which is fun. This is a film, because this is a Sid Caesar film in the late 60s. This has a similar vibe to the Bob Hope films of the late 60s, the Don Knotts films of the late 60s, the Jerry Lewis films of the late 60s, where these are not made for the youth market. There's a generation gap going on in Hollywood at this time. You know, the independent films, the edgier films, and the youth-oriented films are really on the rise by this time. And in 67, you got Bonnie and Clyde. This is made for the parents. And if it seems like it seemed like a dinosaur in 1967, and it really does in 2018. You know, everybody in it is fine. It's just not the funniest material in the world. But it's interesting to see a young Pryor and a young DeLuise starting to do little things that they'll be more famous for later in years. But the other thing of note with this film is that it's produced and directed by William Castle. And I did not know he did this. It is not, he's done cheaper and schlockier stuff, and he's known mostly for the, kind of the horror stuff, but he did this as well, and he got to do this for Paramount. He actually wound up doing a couple of films for Paramount in the late 60s, early 70s. So now I can say that I have seen The Busybody. All right, here's your Sergeant Stubby and American Hero update. I was talking with Evan Dossie about this. Now, Evan Dossie loves Paddington 2. My obsession with Sergeant Stubby isn't that big. I'm just intrigued about what type of audience this film was going for. This is, of course, to review the story of an animated true story of the most highly decorated dog in the U.S. Army. in World War I, a dog who becomes a mascot to an army platoon and then winds up going overseas. And we have such heroic things as finding fellow soldiers, pointing out bombs, pointing out spies. It's a cute looking film. It's not the most expensive looking film in the world, but it was I wish I had taken credit for this, but The Onion wrote it's for a very niche audience, maybe all American families and, you know, safe, wholesome cinema, that a film that shows the horrors of World War I in a non-blood-stained style. But The Onion said it was for films, a film for families who want to learn about World War I or learn about the atrocities of war but aren't ready for War Horse or Wonder Woman. There's a character who gets shot in the head. You don't see that, but you see a helmet with a bloodless hole in the helmet. Things like that. Well, it opened in its opening weekend, because that's where else it would open, opened number 16 in ranking. So, I'll get to that. Ranked 16th, about 1.16 million. I think John Hamm's film made a couple hundred thousand dollars more. And then second weekend had a drop of 50%. And this opened in 1,600 screens and dropped to about 1,300 screens its second weekend and made about half of what it made opening weekend. By the third weekend, April 27th through April 29th, it had dropped down to 36th in the ranking, an 84% drop in its weekend gross, and went from 1,300 screens to 130 screens. That's a big drop. And according to Box Office Mojo, they have a list of the what they call the worst opening weekend per theater averages, wide releases only, 600-plus theaters. Of the 200 films listed, and man, this is a right bunch, Sergeant Stubby, An American Hero, was number 25 all time, just edging out The Danish Girl, the Academy Award-winning The Danish Girl. Now, I have said many times, box office receipts does not reflect film quality. It just doesn't. I looked through the worst opening weekend per theater averages. Number 15 is Green Room, which I really liked. And I was going through some of the titles what made this list that I liked. Films like number 53 is Red Belt, number 60 is 99 Homes. Number 97 was your best picture winner, The King's Speech. So you got to take these with a grain of salt. So, but I bring up the box office receipts because Sergeant Stubby ran in my neighborhood theater in Richmond, Indiana. That's another story for another time. And I saw the 50% drop from first weekend to second weekend. It ran a second weekend in Richmond. I don't think that happened here in Indianapolis. So just an intriguing footnote. It will get on video very soon, I'm sure. Again, the dog is cute. The story, it's just for a very narrow family audience. So there you go. Okay. Got a couple updates for you. I mentioned the Art Craft Theater. Yes, I did. The Midnight Movie Series at Keystone Arts that was just announced, that I had to make a clarification. I think I accidentally lumped Yellow Submarine into the Midnight Movie Series. That is incorrect. So there is going to be a Fathom-like screening, or, you know, they're going to do a one-off screening of Yellow Submarine Monday, July 9th. But your Keystone Art Midnight Movies for the summer, June 8th and June 9th, Big Trouble in Little China. June 15th and 16th, Suspiria, the extended version. June 22nd and 23rd, Spirited Away. June 29th and June 30th, The Room. Yeah, you're probably going to hear the interview. July 6th and 7th, Jaws. July 13th and 14th, Mean Girls. July 20th and 21st, Stop Making Sense. And July 27th and 28th, Akira. All of those happening at the Keystone Arts at midnight all those weekends. Okay, since I mentioned a Stanley Tucci film that he adapted and directed, one of my favorite quotes in film sociology interview history involves Stanley Tucci, and it's also a blatant excuse to play this.
Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Padma. How are you?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
We're hanging here in Indianapolis.
I'm good. I'm good. We're just, we're sitting here drinking up some coffee. Very happy, jittery people.
Well, that's good to know. When it comes to summer, what is the first dish that you think of?
Well, you know, I think there's nothing so classic in summer as ice cream. And I'm going to show you how to dress up ice cream and make it into a fabulous dessert and give your guests a coffee all rolled into one. And the recipe is so easy, but if you don't write it down, it's on Nespresso.com. Basically, Nespresso makes these great espresso machines. Their coffee machines are renowned all over the world. And they basically have a Pixie machine, which is the one I love. It comes in a lot of colors. You pop the little capsule of coffee in. It's the best possible coffee. You make the espresso. You just take a beautiful, simple scoop of vanilla ice cream, put it in a coffee cup, pour the espresso hot over it, sprinkle some chocolate chips, and drizzle some caramel sauce. That is it. You could add nuts. You could add cinnamon. You know, you could add peanut butter chips. But that's the basic recipe. And again, if you're... viewers are, you know, sorry, if your listeners are driving or whatever, it's on the website. Go to Nespresso.com.
Sounds like a good movie treat as well.
It's awesome, honestly. It, you know, they have this beautiful milk machine called the Arachino, and it's basically you just plug it in and it steams up the milk and gives you that foam, just like those high-end coffee bars all across Italy and Switzerland and France. It foams everything up. It steams the milk in 1 second. It's beautiful. Actually, probably about 30 seconds, but it's so easy to do.
Well, can you tell us a little bit of what's in store for season 10 of Top Chef?
Well, we haven't filmed it yet, so there's not much I can tell you. We're in pre-production right now. I think we're just all racking our brains and figuring out how we're going to top Texas from last season. I mean, we had such an incredible, incredible season, and we're just gearing to shoot. It'll probably be on the fall. And I think we're trying to shake it up again. I think you'll see a lot of surprises. I mean, you know, Charlize Theron and Patti LaBelle were on last season, so who knows who they'll come up with this season.
Padma, we can top Texas, Indianapolis.
Sounds good to me.
So I was curious, when you see somebody cooking in a movie, do you pay extra special attention to see if they're actually doing it right?
You know, that's a great question. I do, actually. I'm a big freak about continuity. Because, you know, I come from theater and I've done a couple of movies, and so I can always tell when there's not continuity or when someone's phoning it in. And, like, you know that scene in Jerry Maguire where Renee Zellweger answers the door? Watch it. When they cut to his view, her necklace is tied differently.
Ah, yes. So movie-wise, who can cook?
You know what? Stanley Tucci can cook his face off. That is not... He is not playing. Everything in Big Night is very authentic.
Great
so
film.
So can Martin Scorsese. His first student film was a film about his mom's spaghetti sauce. He gave me a copy of it. It's brilliant.
And didn't she do all the cooking in that one kitchen scene in Goodfellas?
Yes. That's an incredible scene.
So anytime we're going to see you in a movie anytime soon?
I have a couple of offers, but my problem is my scheduling. You know, you have to really do one thing and do it well. I haven't been in a movie since I started Top Chef 5 years ago. My last film was for the BBC. I would love to do another film. It just has to be the right one and work with the schedule, which is not always easy. I'm just thankful for my job on Top Chef at this point.
Of course. Padma, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care, Matthew.
All right, you too. Still waiting on Top Chef Indianapolis. We'll see. All right, I want to end the show with a little tribute, musical tribute, to drummer John Jabbo Starks, best known for his work with Bobby Bland and especially James Brown. He passed away on May 1st. Of course, James Brown music has been used countless times in films, but here's some that Jabbo Starks played drums behind. You'll recognize these. Enjoy a little medley.
One, two, three, four. Get on up, get up, get on up, stay on the scene, get on up, like a second.
machine. Get on up, get up, get on up, get up, get on up, stay on the scene. Get on up like a sex machine. Get on up, get up, get on up, stay on the scene. Get on up like a sex machine. Get on up. Wait a minute, shake your arm, then use your palm. Stay on the scene like a sex machine. You got to have the feeling. Shoot your bone. Get it together. Right on, right on. Get up. Get on up. Get up. Get on up. Get up. Get on up.
Sex Machine, The Big Payback. The Payback. And then Super Bad. Three songs from James Brown, all featuring John Jabbo Starks on the drums. So you got to look, because Clyde Stubblefield also did some drumming, and then they also did, both gentlemen played together. So this is a part of All Music and IMDb. So anyway, Mr. Starks passed away at the age of 79. So, ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by. Soylent Green is people. Zardoz has spoken. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Or go rent one. And happy graduation weekend, everybody. Big show next week. McKenna Mays will be in the host seat interviewing John Krall, and I'll be there as well. So until next time, go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Hey! Got to pay back! Revenge! Get back. Payback.
All right. On that note, you're watching Film Sociology.
No. That's not what I said.
This is pretty much the worst video ever made.
Shut up! My God! You have no freaking life!
I think it's overrated.
Shut up, you!
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!